Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and co-parents of all ages, this podcast is for you. Introducing in the center ring, the amicable divorce expert, Judith Weigel.
When I was with the circus, I never imagined I would later be working in the field of divorce. But divorce can be a circus all its own, if you let it. One of the celebrity divorces we're going to discuss today, it didn't get to be a circus, but the other one ends up being a three-ring affair. We're going to discuss the Bezos divorce and then the Gates divorce. And of course, we have as our go-to attorney in all matters of divorce, celebrity or non, attorney Matthew Smyrda. And thank you, Matthew, yet again.
Thank you, Judy. Happy to be here.
Oh, my God. Okay. So even though the Bezos divorce is over, I think this is a really interesting example of a very amicable divorce. Huge money, richest man in the world. Nothing salacious came out, no arguments. It was just cut and dry. And I wanted to go through some of the aspects of this divorce and look at it through the prism of how it affects everybody else. Their settlement terms are no different than ours. It's just an enormous number of zeros and commas added to the divorce settlement. So the very first thing was there's no prenup.
Right. I was surprised about that. But then again, not quite so surprised, just given that the length of the marriage and how, the two of them were together. And it sounds like she was a pretty integral part about Amazon in its startup days. Not saying that she was, putting in the equal timeshare to him with respect to work in the company, but just being there and probably making it possible for him to build the company into what it was. Without a prenup, though, all bets are off when it comes to a company like that.
Absolutely. But, I remember reading years ago that Amazon was created on a car ride on a vacation that they were having, and they were brainstorming ideas. Did you hear anything like that ever?
I have heard it before, obviously not to the scale of a company like that, but I have heard things like that in my other cases. But with respect to Amazon specifically, I didn't know that. I always was of the belief that Jeff Bezos was working. I think he was working in either private equity or maybe on Wall Street. And he saw this opportunity, huge opportunity, to use the internet to sell things. And then he figured, oh, the easiest thing to sell would be books because it's easy inventory to manage. And that was how it came to fruition. I didn't know. But it doesn't surprise me that, you'd be maybe sitting in a car on a vacation or going somewhere and you happen to drive by a bookstore and all of a sudden, boom, oh, wow, why don't we sell those on the internet, not have to pay for a store?
It was a year after they were married. Mm. Amazon started. And isn't it funny? And I brought this up to the Amazon employees at the Century City Mall in the Beverly Hills area, that isn't it funny that Amazon started as a bookseller and so many of the brick and mortar bookstores are no longer in existence because of Amazon, and Amazon now has a bookstore.
Right.
That's really hysterical.
It is.
Okay, so this is very amicable. She became the first employee of Amazon, and they're going to continue to work together. So, all right, Washington State. Both Gates and Bezos are in Washington State. Yes, they have homes everywhere, but they both chose to file in Washington State. So I looked up, is Washington State a no-fault divorce state? Yes, it is. Is Washington State a community property state? Well, it kind of is. It's an equal distribution of wealth state, not exactly community property. Can you explain those nuances?
Sure. I mean, again, I don't have a ton of experience with Washington versus California, but there are differences, and really it goes to differences between community property and, I think, equitable distribution. Is what you had mentioned. And really, I guess the simplest way to describe it is you're trying to accomplish essentially the same result, an equal division of assets that were accumulated during the marriage. But how you get there and how you calculate what that is and how you quantify that is a very, very different approach under community property versus equitable distribution. So combine that with the scale of what you're talking about here, which is, you know, billions upon billions of dollars, slight differences in methodology that probably wouldn't affect most people too much in the average, you know, average couple getting divorced could have billions of dollars of consequences in Washington versus California. Now I will say I'm sure it's probably a consequence of other things that they did. I don't know enough about it, but I'm sure, you know, filing taxes in Washington versus California is lower taxes in Washington, since California has a reputation for being one of the highest in the country.
Yes.
Right, as we all know. So on paper, you know, the ties to Washington probably required it to be filed there. But I'm sure behind the scenes, you know, there were lawyers from very large law firms that may not be from Washington that were involved in this. It's probably a team of local Washington family law specialists, the best of the best there, combined with attorneys from, you know, large international law firms that are experienced with the company, probably the corporate counsel for Amazon or, you know, big, you know, we'll call them white shoe law firms like that.
Well, in regards to this equitable distribution of wealth, you know, one of the things that the articles that I was reading talked about was, well, who is really responsible for building the wealth? And that would be a starting point. We don't really know any of that because it was so amicable and pretty much so under the wire, all the details. Just a few of the little things I was reading was she gave up her interest in the Washington Post and a company named Blue Origin. I don't know what that is, do you?
No, I don't.
And then as well as she gave up 75% of their previously shared Amazon stock. So I guess mathematically, she retained 25% of their shared stock if she gave up 75%. I mean, sounds like it. And her name is Mackenzie, by the way. I will use her name.
Sure. It's probably not that simple. I mean, in California, it really wouldn't make a difference who was responsible for the growth. The only thing that matters in California is, did the work efforts happen during marriage or before marriage or after separation? So that points out one of the key differences probably between the equitable distribution model versus a community property model. If this were being done in California, it wouldn't matter. I mean, just the fact of being married would make it a community property asset, or the growth and appreciation being apportioned to the community through these various calculation methods that we have. So that's just showing you a difference between how things work. But you know, it's probably not limited to just the divorce accounting and the divorce calculation. There's probably some impact of how splitting up the shares would affect decision-making power from a corporate standpoint, voting rights, control of the company, things like that. I'm sure that was all taken into account. As it would be in any divorce where, you know, a significant portions of a public company, particularly this one of the biggest in the entire world, are on the line. You don't want to, just because of having a divorce, you don't want to do something that might end up causing both of you to lose, and you lose any sort of, you know, control or decision-making power in a company. So maybe it's possible that even though the shares are being transferred, there might be some other written agreement that requires him to pay her certain money or do an accounting and true up, so to speak, to make sure that she is getting a 50-50 split. But that's just not shown in the judgment, and that's not shown in the division of shares, just to avoid any sort of corporate dilution. We're getting into complicated stuff, and this is exactly why you would have, on a case like that, a team of probably 15 to 20 very good lawyers to think about this from all sides.
So you're kind of really on the money with this. Here's what I read. The best way to go forward, they decided, was for her to still be involved in the company, both of them together involved in the company, to retain whatever interest they have in it. So there's your voting rights, right?
And right.
In having majority say, keep it out of the divorce, exactly what you just said, and proceed as business partners instead of selling assets and paying her a lump sum.
Right.
So you really had it on the money. And then lastly, the article I was reading said they would avoid months of forensic accounting by doing it this way and all the accompanying expense, inconvenience, and publicity, which then affects shares of stock, doesn't it?
Right. And then everybody loses, not just the two of them, but anybody who has a shared, who's a shareholder, who has a vested interest in Amazon, the, you know, millions of people that are employed by Amazon in various capacities. I mean, this is, you know, this is something that you have to be very careful with. And that's, you know, the reason why I believe that is just based on my experience in other cases. Of course, I've never been on a case where they you have a business the size of Amazon, but I've been on cases throughout my career where you have very significant business interests on the line and that, and you have to be cognizant of it. And the only way to truly do that is to bring in a team. And so there have been cases where I've worked, you know, as part of a team with other lawyers. I'm the, you know, I'm one of the family law guys or girls, so to speak. And then you have the corporate folks, and then you have the civil litigators, and then you have the, generally speaking, you'll have like the point man or the point woman, which is the lawyer that the client trusts the most, who's kind of spearheading the team. Or it could even be their CPA, their business manager, whatever it is. So it's generally a collaborative team approach. And, you know, when you have money like this, you know, attorney's fees are the least of their concerns. They're happy to pay collective billable rates of tens of thousands of dollars an hour to make sure that there's not millions or billions of dollars in damage.
Absolutely. And obviously they hired exceptional people because, again, for the value of the settlement, it was so amicable. There was really not a lot out there for people to have water cooler conversations about, or
right.
Zoom cooler conversations in the new world of doing business.
Right.
Okay, so a couple other things about the divorce that come up in every single divorce. Alimony / spousal support, depending on how your state defines it. So in a divorce of this size where, I mean, she at least got $1 billion, if not more, and that was already in the trades, there would be no alimony, right? Because why would there need to be? I mean, her lifestyle probably won't appreciably change with her settlement because, I mean, how much money can you really spend, right?
That's right. I mean, she would have the right to ask for it if it were being litigated, but just practically speaking, no, when you have that much money on the line, there's just so much money there. Why do you have to have this monthly payment from one spouse to the other when everybody's doing just fine and is, you know, like you said, able to maintain that marital standard of living without interruption? So yeah, I would expect and again, I don't know the details, but I would expect that some aspect of the calculation gave her a benefit for waiving spousal support, meaning that she got some assets from somewhere else that she might not have otherwise gotten in exchange for a waiver of spousal support, which is something we do in regular old folks cases too. You know, if there's assets there, we can have a waiver of spousal support and we can have a buyout. We call it a buyout by the payor to the payee. And it's beneficial to both of them in the sense that, you know, the person who has to pay doesn't have to worry about continuing financial ties and paying every month. And the payee also gets the money up front, generally speaking, and can move on with their life. And they don't have to worry about being under the microscope and being investigated as to what are they doing? Are they earning more money? So support should go down. In California, if they end up getting remarried, normally spousal support would terminate. Even if they start dating someone and they move in together, there's authority under the family code in California that would allow for a reduction based on a presumption they don't need spousal support if they're cohabiting. So by having a buyout, you avoid all that. Both people can go their separate ways. The check is cut and they move on and they separate. So it is somewhat common to see that. But that's generally not what the court would do. If you go to trial in California, the court wouldn't do that. So that goes back to what we've talked about before, which is when you're settling and you're mediating, you get creative freedom over how to solve your divorce, as opposed to just going by what the court is limited to under the family code.
The largest settlement I've worked on, and it was completely amicable, was $25 million, a couple who lived close by. And there was no spousal support. They split it down the middle. There was nothing to argue about. He, of course, was the one that created the wealth. And right. He just said, we're just going to split it down the middle. It doesn't matter. I can always make more money. And I'm like, this is so brilliant. This is so cool. I love this. And then just as a little aside, before I bought this company, Divorce Resource Incorporated, and that's how you and I met, working on cases back and forth, Fred Siegel, who is a well-known retailer in Los Angeles, right? Several stores. So the former owner of this company did two of Fred Siegel's divorces. And she was telling me that he was so easy to deal with. He said in both cases, give her whatever she wants. I can always make more money.
Wow.
And I just said, this is the way it should be. But I guess, Matthew, it's easy to say that when you're dealing with wealth above average.
Right.
You know, you can be that. And just from your experience, because you do litigate, when you have wealth, normal wealth, several million dollars of wealth, but maybe you have an issue of one of them has some kind of high conflict personality, narcissism, borderline, you know, things like that. I think that becomes the issue rather than this is a really easy settlement. Why can't we deal with it? That comes into play, doesn't it?
Absolutely. What ends up happening is the emotion takes over the reason. So those emotional issues, those psychological issues, whatever they are, whether it's being angry about someone having an affair, or it's someone having a personality disorder, they're a narcissist, they're borderline, they just can't handle the conflict in a calm, managed way. Those issues then manifest in how they approach spousal support, how they approach child support, how they approach division of assets. And they don't look at it as an accountant would. They don't look at it as a mediator would. They look at it as, you know, the angry ex-husband or wife looks at it, and they just want to stick it to the other person, and they get stuck in the system, and the system is slow, and the system lets you have a go at each other on pretty much any issue you want. You can fight about anything as long as you file the right paperwork. Doesn't mean you're going to win, but you'll get a court date, you know, and the other person has to file paperwork in response. And if you really want to put the pedal to the metal, you can send them all this discovery, you know, trying to figure things out. And you know, people with those types of issues love that. They thrive on it. They love the conflict. And unfortunately, those are also the types of people that tend to go through multiple attorneys through the course of their divorce. You know, there's cases where somebody goes through 7, 8, 9, 10, 20 attorneys over a 3 or 4 year period. And generally speaking, there's a common issue there, and it's not the attorney 1 through attorney 20.
Right, because I would expect in those cases that the client isn't getting what he or she wants. Right. And because they're the ones that are in control of the money and make the money, they're used to getting what they want.
Sure.
Regardless of what it is or whether it's even legal or not.
Well, you see that a lot. I see that a lot with clients who are in the entertainment industry, who are creative types. That mentality works for them in their business, and they have so many people around them who take a percentage of what they do that those people can't tell them no and can't tell them what they don't want to hear. Yeah. And so when an attorney comes in who's just getting paid by the hour and getting paid for their advice, and the attorney tells them what they don't want to hear, this may be the first time they've ever heard that before, you know, and then they're the ones who have the money so they can cut the cord and find a new lawyer who will tell them what they want to hear. And it just goes on and on and on until you finally reach the end, which is when a judge tells them what they don't want to hear. And then there's nothing more to hear because it's over. And then what they do is then they say, oh, well, I want to appeal. I want to file an appeal. And they can file an appeal. I mean, you have a right to appeal. There's no problem with that. The success of appeal is very, very low. I can't remember what it is. I think one of the retired judges told me, and I'm not certain of this, I think only it's about a 10% success rate for appeals that are filed in family law. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, but you have a right to your appeal. So. Yeah.
With that, we're going to move on to a not so amicable divorce. And I have to tell you, it really saddens me what I'm reading in the newspaper about Bill Gates. And I'm not even going to go there with any of that. I'm just going to make a statement that since I'm in the field of mediation, it was starting to break my heart to read these things in public. So let's go there. So again, we have a Washington State divorce.
Right.
We have no prenup.
Right.
Melinda Gates, and there's a Netflix special on Bill Gates. Melinda Gates was working at Microsoft when she met Bill. So that's how they met and got together. And she's really smart too. I mean, you don't get to go out with Bill Gates if you don't have a brain.
Of course.
I mean, this is an extremely smart man.
Yeah.
So in the world of not so amicable divorces, thank God Washington State is a no-fault divorce state, so they don't have to go through that. The media may be having a field day, but at least the court system, and they don't have to go through this. And, you know, the reasons we would file for divorce is irreconcilable differences. That's California. But in Washington, irreconcilable differences is what was mentioned, or incompatibility, or in some states where you have to prove grounds, infidelity, the three I's. But in the Gates case, Melinda is the petitioner, and she filed for irreconcilable differences. Okay, so that's cool. They had a separation agreement first. So it looks like this has been in the makings for a couple years. Why don't you explain to the audience what a separation agreement is before you even do the filing?
Sure. So that's a common tactic for any high profile case, to work out an agreement before anything is filed. That's quite normal, actually, in any cases involving public figures or celebrities or people who need to protect their image. And really, it's atypical, because most people file the petition and then they start thinking about an agreement. Vice versa for these folks. They work on the agreement and try and hammer everything out before the petition is filed. But, you know, you do have the ability to enter into a written agreement with your spouse, where you essentially divorce plan, and you can resolve everything. You can resolve issues of division of assets and debts, child support, spousal support, child custody, even in an agreement. Now, there are some drawbacks to it. I mean, an agreement is not a court order, so it's not like you can show your agreement to the police if you need them to enforce, and it's really not like you could even take it to a bank or anything like that if you need to divide up assets or do anything like that. But it is valid and enforceable once you sign it. There are some complications to it. You know, California has laws that say you have to exchange what are called preliminary declarations of disclosure before you sign such an agreement. Those are basically court forms where you have to list out your assets and your debts, your income and your expenses, things like that. So you disclose, you show to the other side what those things are, so they can make informed consent and make an agreement based on actual things that you've disclosed under penalty of perjury. But I've even done agreements where we've agreed to either waive those requirements for the purpose of the agreement itself, or we just indicate that we haven't done them yet, but we're going to exchange PDDs later, but these folks have a settlement, so we're trying to work it out. I've even had those agreements challenged. I've never had to take it all the way to trial. We've usually settled out all of them because there is authority that says once it's signed, it's a valid agreement. Now, it has to be to a pending litigation per this section of the code called 664.6, but you can also put language in there saying that you understand that, but you want it to still be valid. So anyways, long story short, if you have trust, if you have cooperation, you can have an agreement like that solves a lot of problems before anything is filed. And that's quite normal, and I think it's a good idea. And that's what I think you have here, that they did that and they wanted to come up with a way to live their lives before the divorce became official.
So what do you do then with this agreement that was written before you even have a case number because you haven't filed yet? Do you you can't register it anywhere. It has
no
court authority because there's no case to hinge it to, as you said.
Right.
Do you put language in there that says we both agree that the terms and conditions will later be put into a valid settlement agreement?
You're exactly right, that they'll be confirmed into what's called a stipulated judgment. And so what I've done in those cases is once the case, actually the petition gets filed, creating a case with the court, we then go, we draft up the paperwork called a judgment to just to get that prepared and get it signed off on. You have to wait. You know, there is a 6-month waiting period in California from when the respondent is served with a petition or from when they file their response before the paperwork can actually be officially entered by the court and their marital status can be restored. But you can still work on the paperwork, get it done, get it signed, even submit it to the court, and they'll either hold it or they'll process it with a future date on it. So you would start by preparing that and seeing if both people will sign that. Most of the time they do, but maybe one of them has a change of heart. Maybe one of them doesn't want to sign. Maybe one of them says, I think I got screwed, or, I didn't know about this, I didn't know about that. Well, in that case, then you either have to tear up the agreement and get a new one, or one of you, the one who wants to enforce it, has to file a motion, which we call an RFO, stands for request for order. In California, you'd file an RFO asking for a court order enforcing that agreement by turning it into a judgment under this section of the Code of Civil Procedure 664.6.
I can't remember whether you referenced this or not, but I learned, I don't know, a year or two ago, I didn't know this, but I learned a year or two ago that you can write up a basic settlement agreement and attach it to the petition when you initially file for divorce?
You could do that. Yeah, sure. I mean, I don't do that personally, but you certainly could. Sure.
Okay, so what happens when you have this separation agreement, you haven't yet filed, and assets start moving around? If somebody decides differently, I guess you just account for that once the filing starts and you go through what's going to be divided?
Well, yeah, that's a tricky situation because, you know, if you have a change in circumstances after the agreement is signed that's not consistent with the agreement, that's a real problem. And you would just basically have to either find a way to equalize the difference so they get the same thing they're entitled to under the agreement, or you'd have to have a new agreement that accounts for the change. So that's a tough one. I mean, that's, you know, I haven't had to deal with that, thankfully, especially in a litigation context, but that would be problematic.
You know, when I get people, so, you know, when I file for these amicable divorces as a legal document preparation company, there are times when people want to do their agreement first and then file second. I think for me, I'm more comfortable doing it as a mediation agreement that then can be folded into the larger agreement, and people are okay with that. And I think I'm more comfortable with it because I'm not a lawyer and I don't want to put myself in the position of entanglement. I'm more familiar with a mediation agreement. And so people seem to be okay with that when they come to me. I still like the disclosures exchanged first, of course, because then we really know what we're talking about. And I can be more instrumental when I know what they're talking about because I see it on paper.
Right.
And I want to be valuable to the process if I can. Okay, so one of the interesting aspects of this particular settlement is that if the reporting is correct, Melinda wants to up the ante on what the kids get as their inheritance. So it's been well documented or talked about in the press that as the Gates wealth was increasing, the kid's inheritance didn't. So I've always read that it was $10 million per child. There's three children and they're all, none of them are minor children. I think the youngest is 18 or 19, but graduated from high school. And the oldest, I believe, is 25. So it looks like Melinda might want to change that inheritance. So what would be the she can do anything she wants with her money, right?
That's what I was going to say. I mean, you know, she's once the assets are distributed to her per the judgment and put into her name or into some entity or trust that she controls, she can do whatever she wants with it. I guess to the extent that they agreed not to distribute certain assets, that they agreed to keep them in some kind of an estate plan for the benefit of the children, well, in that case, then they probably would have to have some kind of subsequent agreement or amendment to the trust that would change the way assets are distributed. Again, it's kind of out of my wheelhouse. It's really a trust and estates kind of question, which I don't handle. But I think just conceptually, that may be the issue, because you're right. To the extent that she herself personally is getting assets distributed to her, she can do whatever she wants with them as soon as they're distributed. That's her money. It's her separate property once it's distributed.
Okay, so I know you don't work on wills and trusts and all of that, but if there's obviously a will.
I'm sure, I'm sure.
That names the amount of money the children are getting. So right. That will is going to have to change because you're now having two separate entities as opposed to a married couple creating a will and naming their children as beneficiaries. So when does the will get changed? After the divorce is final?
Well, it normally, yes, because once a divorce is filed and served, these things called the ATROs, stands for automatic temporary restraining orders, come into place. And those prohibit certain things from being done, one of which is you can't make any changes to an estate plan while the divorce is pending under the ATROs. Now, once the divorce is over, the ATROs expire and you can do whatever you want. So the simple answer is you would wait till after it's over. However, you know, sometimes people don't want to wait that long. Maybe somebody's sick. You know, maybe somebody's got a terminal illness and they want to do that. If they cooperate, they can agree to make those amendments while the divorce is pending. There's no problem if they agree. But if one says yes and one says no, then the ATROs say no. I suppose in theory they could try and seek a court order, but I've never seen that work in any of my cases where the court would exercise its discretion to allow for estate planning. Because, you know, while the divorce is pending, until the assets are divided, you know, they belong to the marital estate.
There is one thing I read that I just have to share because it made me smile beyond belief. And this is about the children inheriting $10 million as opposed to more. And let's see, the lawyers added that given the Gates' substantial fortune, leaving the sum of $10 million to each child would be, quote unquote, tantamount to disinheriting the children.
Oh, wow.
I love that.
Wow.
Oh, my. And then I'm going to reference Warren Buffett a second. He's not getting divorced. And he doesn't want to leave a ton of money to his kids either. He's leaving something, you know, proportionally like this. But the kids were interviewed about this, another documentary, and they said, we don't care. We make our own money. Whatever dad gives us is fine. Like, this is so unbelievable. I love all these people. I love reading this. It's like watching a movie.
Okay. An abundance mindset is what you're seeing. It's an abundance mindset. Ooh. There's no shortage of money.
I love that. Yeah. Okay, I need to have more of an abundance mindset starting right now. Absolutely. Okay, so lastly, so it's going to get settled. Everything's going to be fine financially. I think the real issue in this divorce is what was underlying the reason for the divorce. We have no idea why the Bezos divorce happened, but it was 25 years of marriage. Maybe they just grew apart. But I kind of think it's cool we don't know what was the underlying issue. I like the fact that it was amicable. Makes me
feel I agree. I agree with you. You know, it's the way, I mean, you know, we as lawyers make the most money when things are not amicable, because that's when everybody's fighting and spending time doing things and going to court. But truth be told, if you can keep your divorce amicable, you're going to save yourself a lot of money, and you're going to save yourself a lot of aggravation and just stress and the emotion that goes with a battle, because it doesn't matter if you win or lose, it's stressful. It's really stressful, especially if your kids are on the line, your business is on the line. That's, anybody would stress about that.
I know. And that's really where I wanted to finish, and that's the kids, you know, the three Gates children. So I was reading that, I believe it was on Mother's Day, Melinda and the three kids went to one of the Vancouver islands that they rented for $132,000 for the visit, and Bill was not invited. And I'm like, this is so sad. But because I, and the kids were really upset, so the article said, but of the many homes that they have, one of them, and I knew about this years ago when I lived in the Palm Springs area, Bill lives, I'm not going to name the resort he lives at, but he lives in one of the resorts in one of the Palm Springs communities, and that's where he's been. And so, who's the oldest child? Jennifer Gates, the oldest child, I guess, left the island and came to hang out with her dad. And so, let's just start for a second with, it's such a drag for the kids. I don't care whether the kids are minor children or on their own. It is a complete drag when your parents get divorced, right?
Of course. Absolutely. Absolutely.
I do hope they work everything out for these children, because it's so public now and they have to listen to this and read all this stuff. I just can't imagine the pain these kids are going through. I mean, do you really want to know why your parents are breaking up if any of this stuff is true on the other side of behavior and all of that extra relationships? No. And so let's talk about, if you don't have press, which most of us don't have press when we're getting divorced, right?
Right.
If you don't have press, how do you keep from your children the reason why you're getting divorced? How does this even work? I mean, you're a father with children.
Yes.
So you can feel for people. You can feel for your clients who have children. How do you talk to your clients with kids if you can see, well, don't I have to tell them? Don't they have a right to know? Have you heard this before?
I have. I mean, I've heard all of it. You know, I've experienced it myself. I'm a child of divorce. My parents had a really, really bitter ongoing divorce that didn't end when the judgment came. They had post-judgment custody battles, restraining orders, and all of that. So I've been there. I mean, I've lived it myself. And you know, there's not a single answer to this, because it depends obviously how old the children are and how much they know. Because, you know, for example, I think there's a big difference between, you know, telling a 3-year-old child versus telling a 15-year-old child that might have, you know, seen something or observed something or saw them with their person they're having the affair with, whatever it might be. So obviously it's a very age specific and child specific thing, because children have different maturities. I think the global answer to this question that I would say to a client is, that's a great question for a therapist, someone who's trained to help with something like that, whether it be the parent's individual therapist or a child's therapist who's treating the child, or, you know, a co-parenting therapist that these two folks are working with together. I do think, though, that any such therapist would say that the two parents would have to put aside their differences, and they would have to be a united front in what they say, because you don't want, you know, dad saying this, mom saying that, parent one saying this, parent two saying that. You don't want that, because that's gonna show the conflict, and it's going to highlight the problems and probably give the child some stress that can be avoided. So really, I think that's where it would be well suited for anybody who can afford it to bring in a professional.
And don't think, this is my input, don't think that because your child is in college, that they want to hear about everything, they taking sides, parental alienation. It affects people of all ages, children of all ages, when you're getting divorced. So I'm even going to say this to the media, man, I wish you would stop writing these stories because I feel for these kids. I really do. And just like the Bezos are going to continue to work together, I was also reading an article that said the Gates Foundation will go on and Melinda and Bill will still work together philanthropically. They just won't be a married couple anymore. So maybe this will be good to keep the family together, you know, and to show to model to the children that even though there's been some hurt and maybe some things that happened that were tough to take, that you can still actually meet on a different level and continue to grow in another way.
Right.
So I guess that's how I would leave that too. Well, Matthew, thank you for talking about this because I think it's really important divorces to highlight the differences and also to show that yes, even high net worth people can not argue about money. And so maybe this is helpful to other people that have regular money. It's just not worth it. Divide the stuff up and move on with your life. Yeah?
I agree. You speak the truth.
So, Matthew, how can celebrities and non-celebrities get in touch with you for legal counsel or representation?
Well, you can go to my website, which is my last name, Smurda, SMURDALaw.com, SmurdaLaw.com.
Thank you, Matthew. I really appreciate all the time you've given us, and it's just such a pleasure to talk about these cases with you. Thank you again.
Thank you, Judy. Always a pleasure.
And thank all of you for listening. I appreciate each and every one of you because we all learn and grow together. If you would like to get in touch with me, you can reach me through my podcast website if it's for the show, theamicabledivorceexpert.com, theamicabledivorceexpert.com, or if you're in California and would like my services as a mediator, you may go to divorceresourceinc.com, divorceresourceinc.com. So please, I look forward to talking to you next week with always important topics. And as always, have an amicable day.
That's our show for today. Thank you for joining us. Be good to yourselves, be kind to your spouse, and cherish your children above all else.